Hello, welcome to the Creation Podcast. I'm your host, Trey. I'd like to welcome you to the first episode in a series called The Failures of Old Earth Creationism. Many Christians attempt to fit Old Earth ideology into their beliefs, adopting uniformitarian or evolutionary pieces into their worldview. While this is often done in an effort to appeal to science, it actually leads to major issues logically, scientifically, and theologically. And I'd like to take a moment to thank our members and patrons. This particular topic, the failures of Old Earth creationism, was actually voted on by our members and patrons. We provided a number of topics, and this one won in a landslide. So if you'd like to help direct the direction of these podcasts, help determine topics for future podcasts, make sure to become a member or patron. Links are in the description below. But today, we're going to be looking at what is considered by many to be a very strong argument for old Earth. Ice cores, cylindrical cores drilled from the thick ice sheets, are often presented as indisputable evidence of hundreds of thousands or even millions of years of Earth history. But how reliable are these claims? What assumptions lie beneath the surface of these interpretations? In this episode, we are going to discuss what ice cores are and why they're significant, the assumptions and flaws in the old Earth interpretations, and how ice cores ultimately align with the young Earth model. And I have with me today Dr. Jake Hebert, physicist. Thank you for being here, Dr. Hebert.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And I know you're super excited for this episode.
I am.
It's been a long time coming, and there's been a lot of preparation, so I'm excited for this too. But before we begin, I kind of gave a cursory overview of what an ice core is, but you know quite a bit more than I do. So what is an ice core?
Well, like you said, these are just cylindrical cores. I mean, that's what the word means, that have been drilled and extracted from the ice. They're usually broken up into sections, but the total lengths can be thousands of meters. And uniformitarian scientists and old Earth creationists claim that the ice at the bottom of these cores is hundreds of thousands of years old. And they argue that this is a very strong, really indisputable argument for an old Earth. And we just strongly disagree with that.
I was going to say, I've heard this before. And I know that this is something you've dealt with ice cores a lot in your research. So I know that you have a very strong understanding of this. So I want to hear what you have to say about
that. Well, just as a recent example, there was an apologetics conference at Southern Evangelical Seminary in October of 2024. And there was a debate between Dr. Hugh Ross of Reasons to Believe and Dr. Terry Mortensen of Answers in Genesis on whether inerrancy requires you to hold to a particular understanding of the first chapters of Genesis, meaning is it a literal creation account, especially the age of the earth. It was mainly on the age of the earth. Does biblical inerrancy require you to hold to a young earth position was basically the topic. And so they debated this, and I think Terry Mortensen did a very good job. But at the very end, when the very end, Dr. Hugh Ross starts talking about ice cores, and he makes a number of claims about the ice cores. Now, this debate was supposed to be on the scriptural evidence, okay, for young or old Earth. But it's interesting that he, in the final analysis, he's falling back onto what he thinks is a scientific argument, because that shows you kind of what his real authority is.
Right.
You know, when push comes to shove, he thinks that we would say interpretation of the ice data trumps a straightforward meaning of scripture.
Right. Actually, I watched the debate too. It was fascinating. And throughout, I noticed he kept referring to the book of nature
right.
as though it were like supreme almost.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what I think he and other old earth creationists fail to recognize is that these data have to be interpreted. And I want to start by focusing on one particular statement he made. He said, "We know that layers must be annual because they reveal volcanic eruptions and 8 cycles of Earth's orbital eccentricity variation. So, for example, we can see the dust signature of all the volcanic eruptions. We can see the eruption of Krakatoa. We can count the number of years over the past 3,000 years of these different eruptions. The number of layers between the dust signatures of these eruptions is exactly the number we see in the history of the calendar of when these events took place. All right, that statement is badly in error for three reasons.
Okay,
the first is that you can't see annual layers in the deep Antarctic ice cores. The reason for that is that it's a polar desert. The plateau on which these ice cores were drilled is a polar desert, and you have to have a minimum amount of ice accumulation to get the fine layers that you can count.
Right.
And you don't have that in Antarctica. There's also a lot of wind on the plateau, so you do not get these well-defined bands. In fact, I've got a textbook on the physics of glaciers and ice cores, and it states point blank there are no visible annual layers in the Dome Sea ice core, which is the one that Dr. Ross is talking about. So there are no, you cannot count them. This is common knowledge among glaciologists. The second problem with this argument is that, as best I can tell, there are tephra deposits, volcanic deposits, in the Dome Sea ice core, but they're not from Vesuvius and Krakatoa. I've got a 2010 paper where it lists the volcanic ash layers that they found, and it doesn't even mention Vesuvius or Krakatoa. Now, maybe he was conflating some of the Greenland ice cores with the Dome Sea ice core. Okay, now they do claim to be able to count annual layers in the Greenland ice cores, and maybe you do see the Vesuvius and Krakatoa eruptions in some of the Greenland ice cores. But even that is not a very convincing argument for this reason. The earliest volcanic eruption that we can date by eyewitness testimony is probably the Mount Vesuvius eruption, which is just a little more than, around 2,000 years old. Other than that, almost all of these volcanic eruptions that we can date by eyewitness testimony are 200 years old or less. Now, the problem here is that we are not arguing about the ages assigned to the very top of the core. We're arguing about the ages assigned to the middle part and bottom parts of the core. So even if you can use in the Greenland ice core these volcanic eruptions as checks to make sure that your counts are accurate, it does nothing to help you be sure that your counts are accurate as you go deeper into the core. And that's where the real controversy is. So this is a very bad argument for those three reasons.
And it was interesting to me that Dr. Mortensen didn't respond to it because that wasn't the purpose of the debate. The fact remains is that he said these things
yes.
in a debate, and they demand recanting, right?
They really do. And the thing is, Dr. Mortensen, he had no chance to respond.
Right.
Dr. Ross had the last word. So even if Dr. Mortensen had been a full-blown glaciology expert, he had no chance to respond to this.
Absolutely. Okay, so why do they think that these ice cores, I'm imagining here, my imagining is probably not 100% accurate of what they actually look like, but you've got these very long ice cores. How are they dating these then? Where do they get the ideas to even date them from? If the oldest, eyewitness account of a volcano is 2,000 years old, where does this all come
from? Okay. Well, in Greenland, they think they can count annual layers.
Okay.
But it's much more complicated than everyone thinks, and the visible bands start to disappear about halfway down the core.
Okay.
And when you get into the bottom of the Greenland cores, they're looking at variations in dust content.
Okay.
And there's just a lot of problems with this. It's not nearly as easy as everybody thinks. In fact, in 1978, there were some pioneers of modern glaciology who said they did not think you could count visible bands back more than 200 years and still be within 10% of the true age.
Oh, wow.
Now, today, they think they can go back 40 or 50,000 years and be within 10%. But we think that more pessimistic assessment is a lot more accurate.
Right.
But what about the Antarctic cores? Those are the ones that Dr. Ross is focusing on. Because you cannot see these well-defined annual bands in those deep Antarctic cores. They are very dependent on theoretical age models to assign ages to those deep cores. And those age models implicitly assume millions of years. Now, for those of us who may have a math or calculus background, you know, if you're looking at their derivations of their models, they treat the height of the ice sheet as a constant, which means you can pull it out of the integral for those people who've got a calculus background. So you know they're treating it as a constant.
Right.
Well, first of all, no creationist or evolutionist believes that a 3 kilometer thick ice sheet just popped into existence overnight. Okay. Right. Nobody thinks that. So even if you're an evolutionist or a creationist, we would all agree that the starting thickness of those ice sheets was zero. So why is it that uniformitarians think they can ignore the time it took for that ice sheet to form? Well, they recognize that the time to form a thick ice sheet, even based on uniformitarian assumptions, is just thousands of years. Maybe around 10,000 years, something in that ballpark. Maybe a little more, maybe a little less, maybe 30,000. Just it depends critically on how fast you think the ice is accumulating. Well, the reason they believe the ice is much older than
right.
that. So, you know, their age model, there's going to be an error. There's error by ignoring the thousands of years it took for the ice to form. But if you believe the ice at the bottom is hundreds of thousands or millions of years old, the error is insignificant. So they can get away with ignoring the time for the ice sheet to form. But that doesn't prove the ice is old. It's assuming the ice is old. So these models are implicitly assuming that the ice sheets are already very old, and they don't, and for that reason, they don't prove anything.
Understood. Okay, so what model are they using here to determine these vast ages?
Okay, well, they've got different models. You know, one of them they call the Donska-Johnson model. There was one called the Dye model. It was an earlier one. They have to calibrate them, okay? Okay. Yes, you know, as long as you believe it's really old, you can use these models, but you still have to calibrate it. So there are chemical wiggles in the ice that they think are climate indicators, okay? Now, what they do is they use a particular theory of the ice age to calibrate that model, and it's the Milankovitch ice age theory. And for people who may not know, the Milankovitch theory posits that for the last 2.6 million years, you've had quasi-periodic ice age cycles. So they would say that for the last million years or so, the ice age cycles have been about 100,000 years long. You would have an ice age that was maybe 80,000 years and a warm period that was 20,000 years. And so they say that's been going on for the last million years or so. If you go back beyond that to 2.6 million years, they claim they were about 41,000 years long. Now, this is all coming from the assumption that climate change is being controlled by Earth's orbital and astronomical and rotational motions.
Dr. Ross did mention, you know,
he mentioned the eccentricity cycle. And we're going to get to that in a second. Okay. So they believe now here's the thing. You know, the Earth's axis is changing slowly. It is changing. It's the direction in which it's pointing is slowly changing. And even the shape of the Earth's orbit, which is defined by something we call eccentricity, is slowly changing. Now, if you believe, okay, the solar system is billions of years old, you can extrapolate those motions backwards millions of years into the past or millions of years into the future. And when you do that, you get these cycles that keep popping up. You get a roughly 100,000 year cycle. That's the eccentricity cycle that Dr. Ross was talking about. You got a 41,000 year cycle. That's related to the tilt of the axis. And then you've got another one called a overall precessional cycle. That's about 23,000 years. Sometimes you might get a 19,000 year cycle as well. The problem is, okay, what they do is they look in the core and they look at these chemical wiggle patterns, and they look for long wave-like patterns, stretches.
Right.
And they assume that each one of those is due to an eccentricity cycle. And so they assume that each one of those long chemical wiggle stretches is 100,000 years long. Well, In the Apica Dome C, they've got 8 of what they think are these long eccentricity cycles. So you want to take a wild guess at what age they assign to the bottom of the Dome C core?
800,000 years.
Bingo. That's it. Okay. And they do the same thing with the Vostok and the Dome Fuji cores. In the Vostok core, you've got 4 long wiggle cycles.
400,000
years. 400,000 years. Yeah. Dome Fuji, you got about 7.
700,000.
Yeah, maybe years. A little, 720,000. But okay. That's how they do it. That's how they date these ice cores. So it's not an independent dating method. Okay, they are implicitly assuming the Milankovitch theory is true and using that to assign ages to the ice cores.
Okay, I just have a question, and maybe they have an answer for this. Maybe you have an answer for this. Why do they assume that chemical wiggle is an eccentricity cycle?
There's no good reason to do that. Okay, okay, there really isn't. Now, let me back up. Dr. Ross's explanation was very oversimplified.
Right.
Okay. Because remember, when they actually measure these chemical wiggles, they're not measuring them as a function of time. They're measuring them as a function of depth down the ice. And if you plot these chemical wiggles versus depth, you will see, you'll see these patterns, but they're not all equally long. They're not all equally long. Like the ones at the top tend to be more stretched out, and the ones that go toward the bottom tend to be narrower. So what happens is when they use their models, including the Ice Age models, the Uniform Materia models, and the Milankovitch theory, it involves something called wiggle matching or orbital tuning. And so because they're assuming that each of these long wiggle cycles is 100,000 years, they use that to assign ages. And what happens is, as a practical matter, when you're putting it on a time scale, the long wiggle cycles at the top, they get shrunk. The shorter wiggle cycles at the bottom get stretched out so that when you put them on a time scale, they all appear to be roughly the same length. And so they say, oh, these are all 100,000-year cycles. But that is not at all obvious just when you look at the raw data. That's after they've interpreted it through this framework. And so I say there's no good reason to think that these are eccentricity cycles. Yes, they're variations of some kind. Right. You had climate variations during the Ice Age, but there is no good reason to assume that these are eccentricity variations.
All right, so they're using this Milankovitch theory to determine all of these ages, but where does the theory come from, and is there evidence for the theory?
Okay, there really isn't good evidence for the theory. Now, if you want to say, is there any evidence for the theory, that depends on how generous you want to be. Okay. But there is no, for someone who's an unbiased, objective scientist who's not already committed to the Milankovitch theory, there is no convincing evidence that it's correct. And this is something I looked very hard into. This is a research project I did at ICR, where I looked into just how strong is the evidence for this Milankovitch theory. Now, the reason that most scientists today believe in this theory is because of a paper that was published in the journal Science in 1976 called The Pacemaker of the Ice Ages. It's a very famous paper.
I've heard of it.
Yeah. And what they did was they had 2 sediment cores that they'd extracted from the deep southern ocean, very southern Indian Ocean. Maybe you could even call it the Antarctic Ocean, but deep south. And there were chemical wiggles in there. And they assigned preliminary time scales to those wiggles. And when they did so, they got climate cycles that had lengths of about 100,000, 41, and 23,000 years, just like the theory said. And so everybody was convinced, okay, this is strong evidence for the theory. Well, what I found out, first of all, there's a lot of problems with the original paper. I don't think the original paper should have ever been published, okay? But even if you ignore all that, the problem is that their confirmation of the theory hinges critically on an assumed age for the most recent flip of the Earth's magnetic field that they no longer accept as valid, okay? So at the time, they claimed that this magnetic reversal happened 700,000 years ago. Well, today, they claimed it happened 780,000 years ago. Now, there are magnetic reversals, and we creationists think those were triggered by the Genesis flood. So they're just a few thousand years old, but they believe that these magnetic reversals have been going on for a long time. But what I was able to show is that if you take that age change and you do the exact same analysis that they did before, the analysis that supposedly confirmed the theory, and you take that revision into account, the results no longer align with the theory. So it is very, very shaky. And again, whether or not you want to say there's any evidence for the theory depends on how charitable you want to be. I would say there isn't. Certainly no convincing evidence.
And so what did, other than just finding out that, hey, there's a lot of problems, have there been any responses to that?
Well, we've been beating the drums about this since 2016. And for the longest, there was no public response of any kind. However, in 2023, there was a fellow who criticized my work. And so I responded to it. He graciously gave us permission to reproduce his comments, and we responded to them in a Journal of Creation article, which is published by one of our sister ministries. And people can decide for themselves who they think got the better of that exchange, but I think I did. And not because I'm anything great, but I think his problem was that he just couldn't believe that his fellow scientists had messed up that badly, and they had. And he was just assuming, like so many people, that the evidence for this theory just has to be strong, but it's not. It's not.
I mean, it sounds like there's a little bit of confirmation bias there.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
I also heard Dr. Ross say in his closing statement of the debate, something about changing Newtonian physics, right, or getting rid of it. What's going on with that?
Okay. There's two ways. There's a quick way to answer that and a longer way. We'll do the quick way first. All right. Dr. Ross is an astronomer. Okay. Now, just because you're an astronomer does not mean you have to accept the Milankovitch theory. There was a very famous astronomer named Fred Hoyle, a renowned astronomer, who ridiculed the Milankovitch theory. He thought it was ridiculous. So this idea that if you don't accept the Milankovitch interpretation of the data implies you're rejecting Newtonian mechanics, that's just silly.
Right.
All right. But there's another way to look at this. Okay. And I do this in my book, The Ice Age and Climate Change, A Creation Perspective. Okay. Dr. Ross is assuming that these changes in climate, these ice age cycles, are occurring like clockwork. Okay, perfect. Now, of course, I don't think that's true, but let's just assume that for the sake of argument. Let's imagine those chemical wiggles in the ice. Let's make an analogy. Remember those old-timey seismographs where they would have a stylus that would write on a piece of paper, mm-hmm, okay, and the paper would be spooled out.
Right.
Okay, well, let's make an analogy here. Let's say the stylus is these rhythmic, perfectly rhythmic variations in climate. And let's suppose the paper is the ice, okay? And so instead of a stylus that can move freely in response to an earthquake, we got one that's going up and down in perfect rhythm, okay? Now, when you do that, you're going to get this wave-like pattern. It's going to be a very nice, simple, straightforward wave, very similar to the wave pattern that he had on his chart, mm-hmm, okay? Here's the problem, though. The wave pattern that you get does not just depend on the motion of the stylus. It depends on how quickly the paper is being spooled out. Okay, if the paper spooled out faster, the wiggles are going to get stretched out. If the paper is spooled out at a slower rate, they're going to get squished together.
Right.
And nobody, not creationists or evolutionists, believe that the ice was deposited at a perfectly constant rate. So what that means is you got to take this into account. And as creationists, we think there was a period during the ice age, right after the flood, where the ice was being deposited at an extremely rapid rate. So the problem is that wiggle pattern you get does not just depend on the motion of the stylus. Even if you assume that the climate was being moderated perfectly by these clock-like astronomical motions, you're not going to get that simple pattern. And it gets worse. Because once the ice is deposited, guess what? The paper starts to shrink in the long direction. And the amount it shrinks depends on how old it is. The oldest ice, the oldest paper gets shrinked more, but the amount it gets shrunk depends on how old you think it is. And the more recent one doesn't get shrunk at all or only very little.
Right.
So this is a flawed analogy that he's making, where he's assuming that if you had perfectly clockwork climate cycles, that that somehow means you're going to get this nice, very nice, tidy waveform, and you're not. It's much more complicated than that. So he's really oversimplifying here.
Okay. That is, I love the analogy, because that made it make sense in my brain. I can imagine that now. And I'm thinking like, oh, the paper, what if the paper jams, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. In my mind, at least, it's like, hey, there's just a bunch of assumptions being made. There's a bunch of already determined factors that but they have decided in their mind, this is true. And that, in essence, determines the age that they give to these things. So, and I think this is a larger problem, because most mainstream conventional scientists would say, hey, you know, that's how old or older the Earth is, right? Okay, so Dr. Ross also says, with no exceptions, all reliable scientific age measuring tools confirm that the universe and the Earth are billions of years old, which, if that's true, that totally throws everything that we believe on its head.
Well, here's the question. How do you define reliable?
Right.
Okay. And first of all, one minor quibble here, maybe it's not minor, you don't measure age. There is no device where you can point at an object and it'll measure. Age is always calculated. These are always calculated age estimates based on assumptions about the past. And if the assumptions behind those calculations are wrong, the ages are wrong. Now, again, how do you define reliable? As creationists, we think there are lots and lots of methods that actually point to relative youth, and they actually outnumber the ones that seem to favor an old universe. The ones that people fall back on primarily are radioisotope dating, distant starlight, but you got all kinds of arguments, even within our solar system, that things are a lot younger than what we're being told. So I don't accept the premise of that question. It's kind of like, you know, no respectable scientist believes in creation or doesn't believe in evolution. Well, how do you define respectable?
That in and of itself is a logical fallacy.
Yeah, it's a loaded question. It's a loaded argument. Yeah.
Okay. So you mentioned that there's actually evidence that points towards youth. Can you maybe just give us your favorite, and then we'll dig into some more?
Well, since we're talking about ice cores, let's talk about some evidence from the Antarctic ice sheet that these ice cores are young. Okay, there's positive evidence for that. Ironically, it involves these tephra patterns that Dr. Ross was talking about. Okay, you can see ashlar, you know, when you have a big explosive volcanic eruption, you will often get a layer of ash or volcanic debris that falls on the ice. Not always, but sometimes you do. And so when they drill these cores, you can actually see ash layers in them.
Right.
Now, remember, they're claiming that the bottom of these three ice cores are 800,000, 720, and 400,000 years old. Now, it turns out that their age models preferentially assign nearly all the time to the bottom halves of the cores, typically about 85%.
Oh, wow.
That's a lot. Okay, so we're talking many hundreds of thousands of years. Now, let's just assume for the sake of argument that these models are correct. If it really is true that the bottom halves of the cores represent, you know, 600, 200,000 years, who knows, you know, lots of the time, then you would expect the vast majority of those tephra deposits to be in the bottom, right? I mean, if it's 85% of the alleged time, the vast majority of those tephra deposits ought to be in the bottom halves of the cores.
I mean, that's more time for volcanoes to
explode. Exactly. Yes. Yeah, exactly. And nobody's saying it's got to be exactly 85%. All right. There's a random element. I will grant you that. But the vast majority of them ought to be in the bottom. They aren't. When you look at how these tephra patterns are distributed with depth in the ice, they're more or less uniformly distributed. And when they use those age models to assign ages to those tephra deposits, because they're assigning hundreds of thousands of imaginary years to the bottom halves of the core, you got these tephra deposits that in reality, maybe they were separated by decades or centuries, but their models insert hundreds of thousands of years between them. And so it looks like they're separated by multiple hundreds of thousands of years. And so in all three of these cores, what you see is this ridiculous drop in frequency as you go back in time. There's hardly any tephra deposits in time. Okay, going back 800,000 years, 700,000, 400, there's hardly any tephra deposits. But when you hit around 200,000 years, all of a sudden, bam, 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 you get all these tephra layers. That's a systematic error because their model is cramming hundreds of thousands of imaginary years into the bottom halves of those cores.
Do they have a response or like even a reasoning behind why there's fewer volcanoes?
Okay, eruptions? Well, they would just say that for some reason they were less frequent in the distant past. But okay. To me, that's kind of a lame argument.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not a very strong argument. We can make another argument, okay? It's not just the spacing of the tephra layers, it's the thicknesses. There's one of those cores, the Dome Fuji core, has a tephra layer that if based on their age assignments, okay, and their models, it looks like that tephra layer was deposited continuously for 5 years. Now, that's ridiculous.
Right.
No explosive volcanic eruption lasts that long. And now you could say, well, maybe there was a nearby volcano and it dumped, 2 feet of ash,
right?
And maybe we're misinterpreting because the it gets thinner. You have to take into account the presumed thinning of the ice. The problem is the evolutionists don't believe that. They don't believe that tephra deposit was from a nearby volcano. They think it came from the South Sandwich Islands, thousands of miles away. And not only that, they've done geochemical analysis on the tephra. They think it all came from a single eruption. So you can't say, oh, well, maybe there were multiple eruptions and they were on top of each other and it gave this illusion of a particularly long volcanic eruption. That doesn't work.
So instead, it's one volcano erupting continually for 5 years.
Yes. Okay. Yes. If you take their age assignment at face value.
Which, how likely is that?
No, it's not. And I'm hoping that we're going to be able to strengthen this argument. They've just drilled a fourth ice core in Antarctica that went all the way down to bedrock, down to ice that they think is at least 1.2 million years old. Now, this is good news for creationists because I fully expect that same weird tephra spacing pattern to show up. And I'm really hoping that there's going to be some tephra layers down at the bottom.
Yeah.
Okay, because as you go deeper into the core, those models assign certain amounts of times to different thicknesses of the ice. And so when you get down into the bottom of the Apica Dome Sea core, you may have a layer of ice that's a millimeter thick, but they would say it represents maybe a year. Okay, well, what happens if you nearly double the age? Okay, so now we're not going back 800,000 years. Now we're going back. They were hoping to get 1.6 million years, yeah. All right? Let's say you have even a thin tephra layer down at the bottom. That age model, if you take it at face value, could imply that it was deposited over 30, 40, 50 years. Okay, so this could actually make it even worse for them. And so I'm really eager to see what kind of results if they publish them, what we see from the tephra results from this fourth core.
Because volcanoes don't erupt for 50 years.
No, they don't. And by the way, Bill Nye inadvertently was trying to use tephra in a Greenland ice core to beat us over the head with to show us that we're wrong. But it was ironic because he inadvertently highlighted a point that creationists have been making for decades. And that is, you cannot naively assume that every visible band in the Greenland ice is a year. Okay, so he inadvertently made that same point, because if you do assume that every visible band is a year, you got one that, where he himself admitted it was like a really ridiculously long eruption. And so nobody believes that. Yeah.
So that sounds very positive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so...
Now, we're not through those. There's another very strong argument from the East Antarctic ice sheet that the ice is much younger than what the evolutionists are claiming. There's a buried mountain range called the Gambartsev Mountain Range, and evolutionists for the longest said this thing was nearly a billion years old, around 900 million years old. Now, even though it's buried under the ice, they can use radar ranging and things like that to figure out what the topography of that mountain range looks like. And they were shocked because it shows hardly any erosion. The mountain range is still rough and craggy like you would expect if it had hardly been eroded at all. And they have a very hard time explaining that. And they had some trial balloon explanations. Okay, they said, well, maybe once it gets covered in ice, that can protect it from further erosion. Okay, that even if that works, that's not a satisfactory explanation because they believe that the East Antarctic ice sheet is only 34 million years old. So what was happening to the more than 800 million years that it was exposed to erosion? Okay, that doesn't work. They also said, well, maybe the mountain got eroded away and it got rejuvenated somehow and popped up again, but they admitted they were kind of fuzzy on the details.
Of course.
So neither one of those two, and what's funny is they said, oh, yeah, we solved this, and then a year later they come, oh, we solved it again. Well, that means you didn't really solve it the first time. Now, what's interesting is apparently they were getting desperate because at the Columbia University website, they had a quote about the Gambartsev Mountains where somebody apparently in desperation anonymously suggested that maybe the Gambartsev Mountain Range was only 50 million years old. Well, that would explain the lack of erosion, but that doesn't work because for one thing, there's no reason for a mountain range to be born in their framework at that location 50 million years ago.
Right.
And based on radioisotope dating methods, they claimed the mountain range had to be at least 500 million years old. So this was just an ad hoc trial balloon. Unfortunately, I don't think you can find that quote anymore. It's since been taken down, but we reference it in some of the articles we've published on this. Sure. So those are two very strong arguments that these ice sheets are much younger than we're being told and that these ages that are being assigned to them are greatly inflated.
Absolutely. And it's interesting that you mentioned the radioisotope dating because it's like it's between a rock and a hard place. You have to accept one or you have to accept the other. And if you can't get them to mix, then you have to look at something
else.
And
by the way, it's not just the Gambartsev Mountain Range. There are lots of places on Earth where you have landforms that by evolutionary reckoning have been exposed to erosion for hundreds of millions of years. And they shouldn't be there, but they are. And that's something they have a very hard time explaining.
Mm. Okay, well, let's taper back from the hundreds of millions or billions of years. So we do have these ice cores. We do have these ice sheets. There are layers, we have evidence of volcanic eruptions, et cetera. Where does that fit in like a biblical narrative?
Okay. Well, creationists have had a strong ice age model since the mid 1980s. And creation researcher Michael Ord, who is a former meteorologist for the National Weather Service, this is his idea, and it's a great one. And basically, we think as a result of the flood, during the flood, there was what we call catastrophic plate tectonics. A new seafloor was being formed very rapidly, and the heat from that greatly warmed up the world's oceans. When you warm up the oceans like that, you get much more evaporation, a huge amount of evaporation that comes from the surface of the oceans. And so that falls out is rain and snow and ice. And so you get a huge amount of precipitation during the ice age, and that rapid ice accumulation is how we can get these thick ice sheets to form in a short amount of time.
Right.
Why we don't need millions of years or even hundreds of thousands of years. Okay, because the ice was accumulating so quickly during the ice age, we think you could get thick ice sheets in just hundreds of years. Okay, maybe not 3,000 meters thick, but I mean, maybe 2,000 meters thick, okay? So most of this is going to be during the ice age, most of that deposition. And so that's because of all this volcanic aerosols, the warm oceans. Now, the volcanic aerosols, let me back up. In order to explain the ice age, you've also got to explain why the ice doesn't melt. Okay, in order to get a thick ice sheet, You got to keep the ice from melting during the summer. So for that, you need cool or cold summers. Now, how do you get that? Well, we think there was a huge amount of volcanic activity toward the end of the flood and also during the ice age. And you have a lot of explosive volcanic eruptions that are putting these aerosols up in the stratosphere, and those aerosols reflect sunlight. And we know, based on observations of recent big explosive volcanic eruptions like Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines in the early 1990s, that you get cooler summers. Now, if you have just one big explosive volcanic eruption, it's a subtle effect, okay? But we think there were hundreds of these volcanic eruptions going off during an ice age that was lasting probably hundreds of years, and that gives you a very potent cooling effect to keep the snow and ice from melting in the summer. That enables these thick ice sheets to build up. And, you know, basically it's the Bible's short time scale that makes this work. Here's the interesting thing. Both evolutionary uniformitarian scientists and creationists would agree that if you have warm oceans, you get a lot more evaporation. That's going to put more moisture into the atmosphere. Both creationists and evolutionists would agree that explosive volcanic eruptions can cause summer cooling. So why can't uniformitarians make better use of warm oceans and volcanic cooling to explain the ice age?
Because there's too much time.
Okay, these volcanic eruptions, they claim, were deposited over millions of years, right, not hundreds of years. And so when you spread out those volcanic eruptions by millions of years, the cooling effect is so diluted, it doesn't do anything. And to warm the oceans enough to get that kind of evaporation, you need something catastrophic. You need something like the Genesis flood. And because they're uniformitarians, they are not willing to entertain that possibility. So, I'm sad to say a lot of Christians seem to think that the Bible's short time scale is something that we need to sheepishly apologize for. It's not. It's the key to resolving and answering these mysteries of Earth history, mysteries that even now still perplex uniformitarian scientists.
Even though they claim that they know them, or right, they claim that it's true.
Right, right.
I do have a question about the Ice Age in general for, some of our viewers and listeners who may be kind of unfamiliar with the idea. In pop culture, oftentimes Ice Age is presented as, oh, the entire Earth is covered in ice and snow. I know that that is not what you're talking about. Can you give kind of like a glance of what a biblical Ice Age might look like?
Sure, sure. We think what they call the last Ice Age was the only Ice Age.
Right.
And evolutionists would agree, uniformitarians would agree, that ice probably covered 30% of the Earth's land surface compared to 10% today. So the ice sheets were bigger, but it's not like the entire Earth was covered. Now, they claim, a lot of them, that the entire Earth was frozen hundreds of millions of years in the past, even billions of years in the past. However, the evidence for those other ice ages is very weak. Basically, they're looking at these scratches in rock. And the reason, if you take plate tectonics into account, you find scratches in rock that they think eons ago were close to the equator. But one thing that can cause those scratches in rock is when you have ice embedded in the glacier and the glacier advances, it scratches the rock. But that's not the only thing that can cause that. You can have underwater debris flows, landslides, things like that can also cause these scratches. And we think that's really what they're misinterpreting that as evidence for multiple ice ages. And as far as the Pleistocene ice ages, the ice ages going back 2.6 million years, the evidence for that is even weaker. Okay. You don't have clear geological evidence for multiple ice ages, because even if you believe the multiple ice ages happened, as the glaciers advance, they're going to bulldoze and destroy the geological evidence for the previous ice ages. Okay, so you're not going to see, maybe you might see evidence for one or two, maybe three. You're not going to see clear evidence for the 50 ice ages that they're claiming have happened. So why do they say there were 50 Pleistocene ice ages in the last 2.6 million years? Well, I'll tell you. Okay, it's because once they became convinced the Milankovitch theory was true, they started using it to assign ages to ice cores and other deep sea sediment cores. Well, there were 57 deep sea sediment cores from around the world, and they used the Milankovitch theory to assign ages to the chemical wiggles in those cores. And then what they did was they put them all on a common time scale. Okay. Some of them they thought overlapped, some of them they didn't. But they put them all on a common time scale. And once they did that, they got this big composite data set that they call a stack. And if you count the number of wiggle cycles going back to 2.6 million years, guess how many wiggle cycles you've got?
50.
50, maybe 50 plus or minus a few. But that's it. That's where that claim is coming from. That's it. It's not based on strong geological evidence. It's based on a Milankovitch interpretation of these chemical wiggles in these deep seafloor sediments. And as we said before, we don't think there's any convincing evidence the Milankovitch theory is even true.
So to me, this looks a lot like there was a bad science, a domino effect of bad science, more or less. So Milankovitch theory, even though it's not very well supported by the science, and as time goes on, it's even less supported by the science. But because all of these decisions and all of these equations and all of these models are based off of it, they're still using it. And that's how they're deriving all of this information. That is faulty.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, one thing about the Milankovitch theory is there's always been a bunch of stuff about the theory that doesn't make any sense. And even if you get a secular or uniformitarian paleoclimate textbook, they will admit there are paradoxes and mysteries about the theory that don't make sense. Right. The one thing the theory had going for it was papers like this pacemaker or the Ice Ages paper that appeared to show these correlations between climate and astronomical motions. And I'm saying now they don't even have that.
Right.
You know, it reminds me of a verse of scripture. Remember how the Lord said, he who has not even what he thinks he has will be taken from him? That's very applicable here.
Yes.
Okay, they thought they had evidence for the Milankovitch theory, but they really don't.
Okay. Why did they not I don't know. They didn't go back after, because you mentioned that magnetic reversal. They didn't go back to try to fix things.
The question, you know, remember I said earlier, they changed the age from 700,000 years to 780,000 years.
Yes.
Why did they do that? Remember I said that once they became convinced that the theory was correct, they started using it to assign ages to ice cores as well as sediment cores. Mm-hmm. Well, in the early 1990s, this technique they use is called orbital tuning. Sometimes they call it wiggle matching, where they basically, you know, they think they have a pretty good idea what they think the climate signal should look like if the Milankovitch theory is true, and they use that to assign approximate ages to those sediments. Well, in the early 1990s, they were attempting to do that. There was a core off the Galapagos Islands that they were looking at, and there were also a bunch of cores in the Mediterranean. And apparently, they didn't come right out and say it, but it looks like they were having trouble reconciling the data with the Milankovitch theory. Now, that orbital tuning method gives you a lot of freedom because you're free to kind of arbitrarily squish and stretch different portions to make it line up. But in some cases, it may be a stretch, if you'll pardon the pun, even for the Milankovitch theorists. Well, they suggested at that time that the ages for the three most recent magnetic reversals need to be bumped up by 5 to 7%. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but by that time, they had already raised the age of that reversal to 730,000 years. Well, if you bump it up to 5 to 7% for the most recent one, you get an age of 780,000 years. So what they did was they arbitrarily overruled the radioisotope dates and said they're wrong, and this is the correct age. So they allowed the astronomical theory to overrule the radioisotope dating methods. Now, so here's the irony. Okay, this is what's so crazy about this. They used an age of 700,000 years for this magnetic reversal to convince the world the Milankovitch theory is true. Years later, they encounter data sets that don't seem to work unless you change the age of that same reversal to 780,000 years. And so they did that, but they conveniently forgot that their confirmation of the theory depended on that earlier age. Orbital tuning is only justified if you have a good reason to think the Milankovitch theory was correct. The pacemaker paper was supposed to be that theory. But when they changed that age reversal, they undermined the results. And so at that point, it is total circular reasoning. Now, in 1996, I think a lot of these guys became aware of that. I think some of them already knew.
Right.
Because one of the guys who was suggesting the age revision was a co-author on the pacemaker paper. It's kind of hard to see, you know, how he couldn't have been aware there was a problem.
Hey, guys, we have an issue. Yeah.
But anyway, they kind of ignored that. But in 1996, they apparently became aware of this. And a year later, a paper was published by Dr. Maureen Ramo, where she was purporting to show that the ice age climate transitions occurred at the times predicted by the Milankovitch theory. And she was using that magnetic reversal, but now it had an age of 780,000 years. So what happened was the original core that they were using as a standard mm-hmm. to assign these ages, they called it an ice age Rosetta Stone. They were so proud. They thought this was the gold standard. They were using it to assign ages. Well, guess what happens when that standard, if you will, no longer confirms the theory? They start going looking at other sediment cores, okay? And they start finding other ways to try to confirm the theory. Now, the question I have is this. If you really believed that particular core was an ice age Rosetta Stone and you can trust the ages coming from it, then why is it that when it gives you the result you want, you accept it, but when the same exact methodology gives you results that don't agree with the theory, you reject it? And I think the answer is obvious. Some of these guys were just in love with the Milankovitch theory and they just couldn't let it go. And so this is not as objective as everyone thinks. By the way, one of the cores that Dr. Ramo used to confirm the new ages, new ages for the ice age transitions, those they still think are the same, but the new age for that magnetic reversal was a core that was right next to the ice age Rosetta Stone.
Okay. Or should be the same.
You would think they would be the same, but one of them gives you the right answer if you use an age of 700,000 years. The one right next to it gives you the right age if you use 780,000 years. So
it's a bunch of nonsense.
it really does. And I'm not, please understand, I'm not accusing them of being deliberately deceptive, right. But this is the reinforcement syndrome. You've got this idea about how it's supposed to be. And so the data are kind of forced into that template.
Square peg in a round hole.
Yes.
You got to make it fit regardless.
You got to make it fit. Yes.
Okay. Wow. Thank you. I love how passionate you are about this and we've shared a lot. I know that all of our listeners and viewers are going to have to watch this one again to get everything from it. We've covered a lot.
And we're going to have links. We're going to have links below this video so that people can read up and find some more information if they like.
Please dig into it. This is fascinating. It's like almost like a miniature scientific conspiracy to dig into. So, all right. So we have, you mentioned the heat model, the one that Mike Ord came up with. And can you kind of give us just the strengths of that model as opposed to this Milankovitch theory?
Well, for one thing, the Milankovitch theory is too weak to really do anything. One of the big problems with the theory is these changes in sunlight that they claim are caused by changes in Earth's motions are really too small to do the job. Now, the mechanism we've got is strong enough to do it. Now, now you may say we have a problem possibly with excess heat during the flood, okay? So maybe we have to dial it back a little bit, but at least our mechanism is strong enough to get the job done. Also, we can explain things that they can't. Uniformitarian scientists are perplexed because there is good reason to believe that woolly mammoths were thriving in Siberia during the Ice Age. Now, the problem for them is that by their reckoning, Siberia has been bitterly cold for a long time, at least 100,000 years. Most people would say more than that, but at least 100,000 years. And the problem is winters in Siberia today are so cold that it's hard to see how woolly mammoths could live there. But to make it worse, the uniformitarian scientists think that generally the climate was even colder during their Ice Age model. So how can you have millions of woolly mammoths thriving in Siberia? Well, so they might say, oh, they migrated. Well, there's various reasons that doesn't work. Okay, the migration idea that they would leave and go farther south during the winter, that doesn't work. There's reasons for that, but that doesn't work. But Mike Ord's Ice Age model gives us a very simple, straightforward explanation. Because the oceans were so warm after the flood, it's going to take hundreds of years for those oceans to cool off. And so because Siberia is now surrounded by all this warm water, it's going to moderate the climate much in the same way that the warm Pacific air helps moderate the climate in Seattle, Washington, even though Seattle, Washington is farther north than New York City. So it's still going to be cold during the Ice Age. Okay, during the post-flood Ice Age, it's still going to be cold, but it's not going to be anywhere near as cold as it is today. And so that is a very simple, straightforward explanation how you could have all these woolly mammoths thriving in Siberia, but again, uniformitarian old earth, and not just uniformitarians, but old earth creationists cannot make use of that explanation because according to their model, Siberia has been bitterly cold for eons. It doesn't work.
So again, we see
that the Bible's short time scale is the key to making this work.
Okay. Okay, so what we see here is old earth creationists, they've got this idea that the earth is old. And as we look into things like what we're talking about today, man, the evidence for that is just so shaky. And scripture continues to support that.
Yes.
Like, hey, the earth is young.
Yes.
What's the takeaway here? What's the takeaway for old earth creationists, young earth creationists, anyone who's listening, really?
Well, I can think of two or three.
Okay.
First of all, and this is, I'm afraid this is a lesson a lot of Christians haven't learned yet. Bad arguments can look convincing. Bad arguments can look convincing. If you didn't know any better and you saw Dr. Ross making those statements, it sounds like he knows what he's talking about. He sounds very confident, but he didn't. What he said was just flat out wrong. It was demonstrably wrong. And so we don't need to be intimidated just because an argument looks good. I think a lot of Christians are too easily intimidated because just because an argument looks good doesn't mean it's right. And by the way, I'm not necessarily criticizing Dr. Ross for talking about ice cores. He's an astronomer. I'm not saying that he can't ever talk about ice cores, okay? Because in Christian apologetics, we often have to branch out and do topics that were not in our original area of expertise,
right?
Okay? But you've got to be willing to do your homework. And from that clip, it was painfully obvious that Dr. Ross had not done his homework. So you got to do your homework. And as Christians, we don't need to be intimidated just because an argument looks convincing. Okay, it can look convincing and it can be totally wrong. And that's something we need to remember.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for being here today. Again, your passion for this topic is just contagious. And again, we mean no offense. We want to make that clear. We're not trying to bash Dr. Ross by any stretch of the imagination, but we want to make it clear that what he's saying is wrong, because Christians listen to him.
I mean, that was an apologetics conference where you had all these Christians, and he's telling them they cannot take scripture at face value.
And that is a problem.
It is a problem.
Scripture is true. It can be taken and read plainly and understood. So thank you so much for just providing your expertise for this.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Absolutely.
A pleasure to do this.
Absolutely. And we'll have you back. We'll have you back in a couple of episodes where we'll be talking about VARVs.
Yeah.
All right. Whatever that is. No, I know what they are.
Okay.
Now, only because I've researched them. So thank you so much. We'll see you in a couple of episodes. And thank you to all of our listeners and viewers for being here. This is a very overdue series of podcasts. And remember that this was voted on by our members and patrons. So if you're not a member or patron, we encourage you to join, to become a member, become a patron, and you can get access to special videos. You can get access to behind the scenes kind of stuff. And you can take part in polls like the one that allowed this series to be made. And we're super excited. Other than that, make sure to like, subscribe, share with your friends. If you have any old Earth creationist friends, this is a great one to send their way. And we'll see you next time on the Creation Podcast.